Good evening, brothers. So Sarah asked me to come and do something with you all, and we had a long debate about what it should be. Fundamentally, he said I should do what I want to do, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. It's always a good thing, isn't it? You know, I'm here for the week, and I shall be talking tomorrow night about social conflict and the mental processes that underlie social conflict, and some reflection on how that bears on us in our own meditation. But I want tonight to take up another topic. I met with the women on Monday, and I talked a lot about karma, which was very interesting. Wouldn't mind doing that again, but I wanted to do something different. And so I'm picking another of my current concerns. An area of concern. And I'm just going to launch into it and see what emerges. For some reason, my life has unfolded in such a way that I'm quite involved with Buddhism in the context of social change and transformation, especially in India. I spend 6 months of each year in India, helping our brothers and sisters there to live the Dhamma life and to communicate the Dhamma, and also trying to take the Dhamma much more widely beyond the present Buddhist community. And it's all very much in a context of overcoming the oppressive caste system and trying to help people to lift themselves out of their very often very, very painful and unjust situation. At the same time, I've developed a connection with some gypsies in Hungary who have discovered the work in India and see it as relevant to them. They are Europe's untouchables, you could say, to use that horrible term. And I've only recently come back from Hungary and visiting our friends there. So for various reasons, my life has unfolded you know, without any design exactly, with quite a strong component of trying to help to use the Dhamma, help people to use the Dhamma to overcome their very difficult social situations and the economic situations that they suffer because of their social situation. And it's made me more and more vividly aware of the power of the Dhamma to transform not just the individual life, but collective life. It's so easy to see why it's important in India. It's easy to see why it's important in Hungary. You can see in India, 18-19% of the population are have been historically considered untouchable. They've suffered deprivation of economic opportunity, of cultural opportunity, of educational opportunity, of political opportunity. And the Buddha Dhamma helps them to gain confidence in themselves, to see themselves as responsible for themselves and able to change those circumstances. The same in Hungary. 6% of the population are gypsy. There's now a very large one can only say fascist movement, I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, in Hungary, that is explicitly anti-gypsy. And these people have suffered a historic oppression. Oddly, the best period for them was the communist period. But since the end of communism, their lives have got worse and worse. And again, the Dhamma, just the very simple basic teachings of the Dhamma, help people to lift themselves up. Because the first message that anybody encountering the Dhamma hears is you are responsible for your own destiny. Of course, you can't overcome gravity, as it were. You can't overcome what the outside world brings to you in an ultimate sense. But you can change your life in such a way that you find greater fulfillment, greater happiness, and even if you take on a life based upon these principles of self-responsibility, your own economic and social circumstances will change. So in India, in Maharashtra, which is the main state around Bombay, where conversions took place, you got one section of the Dalit, that's the sort of generally accepted term for people who were formerly considered untouchable, one section of the Dalit community converted and another section didn't. So you've got a classic control group. And you see a huge difference in the economic, social, educational achievement of those who converted as compared with those who did not. So something like, I'm very, very bad with figures and I always make them up. So let me say, please nobody check me, it is something like this, something like 70% of Buddhists in Maharashtra have high school leaving certificate or whatever. Of comparable communities that didn't convert, about 40% have. And you follow those statistics through in all sorts of fields. So the Dhamma for them is not about meditation. You know, some meditate, but many people, it's about believing in yourself. It's about believing that ethics leads to fulfillment. That's the main thing. It's about believing that an ethical life, a life of non-harm, leads to a just society. This is one of the main messages of Buddhism in India today, that Buddhism, so to speak, supports democracy. Because democracy is not just a form of voting, it's a state of mind. It's an attitude of respect for others, of leaving others free, of equality, of not oppressing anybody else, and an attitude of fellow feeling, that we're part of the same society, the same culture. So they see the Buddha Dhamma as a way of giving themselves a better life and creating for their own society a better world. And you can see the same thing happening in India. You can see, in Hungary. So you see young gypsy boys and girls who have basically skipped the educational system. Until quite recently, most gypsies were classified as mentally subnormal, just automatically. It's in Europe, yeah. And so they were put in separate classes and basically not taught. And the schools get better money for special needs children, but the money doesn't get to special needs children, it goes to the white children, basically. So, but because they are beginning to sort of learn about the Buddhist movement in India, they're beginning to see its parallel for them, they're trying to lift themselves up, they're trying to get an education, they're trying to create a good life for themselves and to create a better society. So I've become very, very used to seeing the Buddha Dhamma as immediately socially effective. When people practice the Buddha Dhamma in this basic way, it changes their relationship to themselves, it changes their relationship to society, and it changes their behaviour within a social context. But, you know, I come from the West. I was a hippie. I was just telling Majid here that I was, came from the 60s, and Asvajit and people like that. We're here because of LSD, the holy god. Joking, but, you know, we came from that sort of background, and in a way we came from a sort of quest for a very personal quest for meaning, for relevance, for happiness. I certainly did, and many of us did have some sort of idea that society should be changed, mainly by putting enough acid in the water supply. I remember that as a serious proposition. But you just needed too much, and it was too expensive. So, But our sort of concerns were mainly, you know, because of personal anomie, of a sense of alienation, a sense that, you know, we ourselves were not fulfilled. I think that probably goes for our generation. But I think in a way it still goes. Most people find their way to a Buddhist center on a very personal basis. Not many people probably come because they think that this has some larger significance. Maybe I'm overgeneralizing and maybe I'm, you know, slightly overweighting it. But let's say that it's coming more from that side than from the way our brothers and sisters do in India or in Hungary, which is mainly from a desire for a better society and a better place in society. And it seemed to me that we really need to think about that again, if we haven't already. We really need to consider whether our own interest in the Buddha Dhamma is of wider significance and relevance. And clearly, I believe that it does. I believe that in this world today, things are not that different from how they've ever been. I don't think greed, hatred and delusion are any worse than at any other time. The problem is that technological development has meant far larger population and much closer interaction between between peoples. And technological development has meant that what happens in one place affects what happens in another. And it means that there are the resources to create very large impact. You know, the classic example is, of course, the Twin Towers. You know, problems which are to do with injustices in the Middle East and so forth have matured in such a way that, you know, two panes were banged into a skyscraper. That's the sort of world we live in now, where injustices and inequalities and ignorances sort of spiral out of control and affect the whole world. And there's so many of them. We sort of tend to think mainly at the moment of so-called Muslim terrorism. There's loads of terrorism of all kinds. Some people even think that in Sri Lanka you've got a sort of Buddhist terrorism. You've got a Buddhist state that is, you know, not really giving justice to people of a Hindu background. That's another question. So we've got a world that's so closely interconnected that, with such technological power, destructive power, that it's becoming more and more dangerous. And it's only a matter of time before some terrorist somewhere or other, of some persuasion or other, gets hold of really serious weapons of mass destruction. So, you know, just from that point of view, we're in an increasingly dangerous situation. As I say, I don't think that the mind of the world as a whole is any different from what has ever been. It's just that the circumstances and the evolution of technology has meant that you've got a larger population because we could support it, and the destructive power is so much greater. Of course, we've also got the power to poison ourselves. I won't go on about that, but you know, our technology and our use of technology has meant that we're doing serious damage to the environment around us and altering our climate and so on and so forth. We all know all about that, and as we should. And I'm only not banging on about it because I can use shorthand and everybody knows what I mean. We're in a very dangerous position. The effect of human activity on the world around us and therefore back on us has accelerated out of all proportion in the last 150 or so years. We know it. I think it's almost beyond doubt. There's a third factor, of course, that we're facing right at the moment, which we'll probably survive and you know, carry on. But it's obvious that the current economic system has serious flaws in it. You know, we've encountered that in terms of the banking crisis. But It seems to me that the problem is not just about, you know, poor regulation in London and New York. It seems to me that the problem that emerged in that, out of that poor regulation, is much more fundamental. And it's revealed by what happened when the G20 met, you know, to try to deal with the banking crisis. I was really struck by this. You know, the great and good of the world, from all over the world, got together, discussed the crisis, and they came up with a solution. And what is the solution? It's a very, very simple solution they came up with. We should all go shopping. That is the solution to the crisis. We should go shopping. I'm almost not joking. Well, I'm joking, but I'm serious. The crisis is relieved by us consuming more. Because the whole system is built on growth. And growth is fueled by consumption, obviously. Consumption is fueled by greed. As a good Buddhist, we know that. So there's something sort of seriously wrong with the whole system. And it's extraordinarily adaptive, and I have a fair amount of confidence that in two or three or four years we'll be cruising again. But how long for? What's going to happen next? Right immediately, well, the Birmingham City Council has cut 2,000 jobs, 20% of its workforce, because of that crisis in the system. So it seems to me that there's a sort of concatenation of problems which make our world a very, very chancy one. We've had these 40 years, sort of most of my adult life, of stability and, well, in Britain at least, it's not if you go elsewhere, but in Britain we've had this extraordinary run of steady growth, political stability, etc. You know, like I tell my friends in India and in Hungary, that I find it really interesting looking at their press, because they have real politics. We don't have real politics here. We have sort of fine shades of grey in the middle, and people fighting for the middle ground, and you know, the Labour Party, which is more right than the Conservative. Oh, you know. We've had this extraordinary long period of stability. Of course, people have been victims and people have suffered, but it's been remarkable in human history, I think, the last 40, 50 years. And I think it blinds us to the real instability of the situation, the underlying situation, economically, socially, politically, in terms of the environment, and in terms of the almost inevitable major man-made disasters, both in environmental terms and in terms of the use of weapons of mass destruction. Well, you know, you can get rather upset about all this, can't you? Well, and you know, you can decide that the only thing to do is go and have another drink. You know, you can just get into sort of horrified worry. You know, sometimes I find the way people talk about environmental problems and so on and so forth really makes me not want to know. There's a sort of a mood behind it that's almost hopeless and very anxious, fueled by panic. I don't think we need to get into that mood. And in fact, I think it's the least helpful thing we can do, because then you don't have a balanced outlook, and you make foolish decisions which are in panic and reaction and going to one extreme or another. It needs to be looked at calmly, positively, with an intention to act for good. That's a very strong Buddhist baseline with all problems. Try to look for how the best can be created from even the worst. So yes, it's a pretty grim picture, I'm sure everybody's had their moments of sort of waking up in the middle of the night and think, we're all doomed, it's all going to end, and you know, what's going to happen? I think many of you are fathers. What's going to be like for your children? It must be, I'm sure that sort of sharpens the issue. You know, you're not going to be around, but your descendants are going to be. So I think we need to bring Buddhism to bear on all this. It's not enough just to think of the Dhamma as something that gives us some happiness, some peace, some satisfaction. I think we need to feel, or I certainly need to feel, that my engagement with the Dhamma is somehow related to and relevant to and even my contribution to a solution to these looming crises. It's not all disaster, of course. There are very positive things happening. There are very positive forces in the world. Not just Buddhists, by any means. There's some very, very good people in the world. And, I would like to think that we as Buddhists were contributing to the solution and certainly not adding to the problem. So it seemed to me that we here in the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, in all our TB, what are we? Tri Ratna Buddhist something or other, community, TBC. I'll get used to it one day. Formerly known as FWBO. It seems to me that we can make a contribution, and we need to make a contribution if we're to feel some optimism, some hope, and not either just to ignore the problems of the world or to just be overwhelmed by them. I would like to think that our Buddhism could be equally powerful in terms of personal transformation as in terms of social transformation and transformation of the world. So I've got there. Where do I go from here? I suppose the Buddhist analysis of all this is in terms of its origins. I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, but you take the Nidana chain, you trace everything back, you trace all human activity back, and you come back into the mind. You come back into the human mind. And especially where unskillful action is concerned, you come back to the mind's ignorance, the unawareness of the real nature of the situation, the real nature of yourself, of your own mind, of the world around you. That's where it all traces back. That's the Buddha's analysis of these problems. Mass weapons of mass destruction, a crazy economic system, an environment that's severely compromised already. All of that traces back to human activity. And human activity traces back to the mind. And the negative element in human activity traces back to ignorance. It's our unawareness of the real nature of this life that leads us to do things that create this mess. It's our unawareness of the real nature of life, of its impermanence, its lack of substantiality, its lack of any fixed final element, ultimate element, its lack of ability to give us, on its own terms, lasting happiness and satisfaction. It's these facts that, our failure to recognize these facts, that leads us to seek more and more things so that we feel okay. It's our ignorance about the real nature of things that leads to greed. And it's greed that fuels a consumer economy. It's greed that fuels shopping. And that leads to a world economic system that's based on the idea of growth. A growth that, it's hard to see as sustainable. So our greed, which comes out of our ignorance about the real way life is and where happiness really lies, leads to a world economic system that is crazy. But it's also very oppressive. In India, since economic liberalisation took place in the late 80s, early 90s, malnutrition has grown. So the economic system that is sort of, you know, our masters, our leaders espouse, actually causes more suffering. When I don't want to argue for communism either, but when the Iron Curtain came down, 90% of gypsies lost their jobs. 90% of gypsies in northern Hungary are unemployed. The Hungarian economy was severely battered, and it's now a sort of it's kind of a dependency of Germany and France and Europe generally. Maybe these things will be resolved. Maybe the Indian economy will pick up. You know, we hear so much about India as a shining India that lost BJP the election. But my observation is that the economic system that we have, it certainly benefits a huge and growing middle class, but it causes a huge amount of suffering for many, many people in India and all over the world. It leaves them living a life in slums, working in very bad conditions for very little money. So that's, you could say, the outcome of a system fueled by greed. I thought quite a bit about terrorism because, I think I could easily have been a terrorist myself when I was young. I'm pretty sure I could. You know, it was the time of the Red Brigades and the Baader-Meinhof and all that. You'd have been there, wouldn't you, SVG? Yeah. So things could have gone a slightly different way, and you think the only way to resolve this is by violence. It's easy to think of that. You can see people, I've seen people in India in such bad conditions that I would not blame them for taking up weapons. And you think what it's like, you know, again, Islamic, what's so-called Islamic terrorism is not really Islamic at all, but terrorism from that background, you can see what it's like. A young guy, you can see what's happening in Palestine, you can see what's happening in Kashmir, you can see the way the Indian army behaves there, you can see what's happening in many places, and you think, this, you know, they're just, you know, kicking us around. I'm going to do something about this. I can sympathise, if you see what I mean. It's the system itself, the way it operates. It's the greed, the delusion, the selfishness that creates systems in which people lose out really badly and then resort to what seems to them the only alternative or only possibility, which is violence. And that happens between states, it happens within states, and so on. What else have we got? Oh, the environment, of course. The disaster that we've got around us in terms of what we're doing to the atmosphere and so on and so forth, what we've done to the countryside. Where's England gone? You've been out there, it's sort of going. That's why I live in Wales. And if it gets any wetter there, I'm going to be drowned even up halfway up Snowdon. It's essentially our technological development that we've had, which has been fueled by a desire for a better life. Why not? I don't see anything wrong with that. But it's got out of hand, and it's not been considered and balanced, and so on. So all these problems, I'm putting it rather starkly, of course, it's much more complex than that, but all these problems have their roots in the aggregation of human activity. And that aggregation of human activity comes out of the individual minds of those who participate in it. And those individual minds are motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion. At least that's a substantial part of it. It's not the only force. There are people working for good. There are people working to heal wounds. There are people trying to bring about resolution. There are people trying to solve problems. But the balance, the destructive balance, is fueled by, these fundamental unskillful roots. This is the old-time Buddhist analysis, and really the situation has not changed. So, the Buddhist analysis is that the roots of all these problems lie in our attitudes, our understanding of things, and the attitudes that emerge from them. To take the problem of overconsumption, to put it that way. It's like weird things, like obesity. I'm going to give you one of my statistics, which please don't quote. I think it was 66%. Say 100%. No, 66% of the American population are obese. I don't know whether I'm obese, but I don't know what it means, whether it means really gross or, like me, slender and well covered. But they're classified medically as obese. It's a huge number. So that means people are, haven't got a mindful attitude to eating. They're not aware of what they're doing when they're eating. They're driven by the temporary satisfaction of taste and the pleasant feeling of fullness and so on. You take a little example like that, and you can see that problems which create health issues for the individual also create a system which is unjust. America's consumption, for instance, India is a major importer now of food material, raw materials from America. And because of the way the system has gone in the last years, its prices have shot up because of the, ethanol and all that. And the way consumption works in America, people stuffing themselves silly, creates huge rises in prices in India. Like in the last year, foodstuffs in India, our friends are having to pay 30% more for foodstuffs because of the way the global economy works, and especially, the huge rise in consumption in China, but also the way that the food economy has worked in America. So you can see what I'm getting at. It's the mind that is the issue, and although there are, of course, technical solutions, there are political solutions, and so forth, the fundamental issue is attitudes, underlying attitudes. You can see in Hungary, the attitudes of white Hungarians to gypsies and gypsies to white Hungarians is the basis of the tensions and the reason why gypsies remain in excluded and in poverty. So in the end, all the problems come down to these fundamental attitudes which emerge from our ignorance, our failure to recognize the real nature of this life. There's nothing that you can have forever. It's not going to last. And you're not going to last. So you cannot find any security in this material world. Bhante said something to me yesterday, quoted from, I think it's the Ratnaguna Samchayagatha, a Mahayana text, in which the Buddha is presented as saying, that which supports is no support. And it's absolutely true, isn't it? If you think that you can rely on something, you think that it supports you, but it can't support you, because at any moment it can dry up, it can disappear, she can walk away, the mortgage can collapse, the economy can go. Like I did a long solitary retreat the year before last, and just before I went into the retreat, I had a little pile of money, very small amount, honestly. And I looked on the internet and I found the best rate of interest, and I put my money in there. And I thought, great, I'll come out of my retreat and I'll have got a nice little extra bit of interest. So I went on the internet when I came out of retreat, I tapped in the address, and up came a thing saying, "Sorry, we've gone bankrupt." It was an Icelandic bank. You just never think of a bank going bankrupt, but they do. Well, for the last 40 years, we haven't. Fortunately, that nice Mr. Brown sent a gunboat and got my money back for me. But things that you think of as solid and real and permanent aren't. They may last your life. They may not. You think there are things that sort of have some reality, that exist out there in a permanent, undying sort of way. Probably the way we mostly experience that is in terms of our relationships with other people. Sometimes think about that the notion of marriage, my marriage. Just to take an example that we're probably all familiar with, either as the descendants or the, involved in it. But actually, marriage isn't a thing. It doesn't exist. What you use when you say the word marriage, you use the word marriage to indicate as a kind of shorthand a complex, ever-changing set of relationships, process. But you think of it as something sort of fixed. And also you can use that term, my marriage. Now, probably most of us would laugh at the idea that we were sort of taken in by that. But actually, we are. We subtly buy into these sort of fixities. We think they have some real, independent, reliable reality. They don't. This is the Buddha's message to us, and it's actually, it doesn't take a lot of thought to recognise it. We still have the idea that somehow if we can get all the bits arranged in the right way, we'll have arrived. We'll pass into that great big advertisement with the sun shining and the beautiful block of flats. No, wait a minute, I'm in India at the moment. Because usually the block of flats is amazing. Blocks of flats always have beautiful girls in them. I really want to buy one of those. And they're much cheaper than here. But you have this sort of idea of a kind of final sort of state in which you'll really have arrived. You'll be happy at last. And everything will be there. Everything will be around you. Everything will be as it should be. And, the music will play and the lights fade. No, they do the opposite. They come up. But it's not like that, is it? You can't get a set of worldly conditions that themselves will provide happiness. Happiness which depends upon external phenomenon is unreliable. Happiness has to be discovered within, you could say. Happiness in the end is a state of freedom from reliance on material things, on the world. That's what happiness is. That's the Buddha's message. Once you're free, you're free. I remember going to IKEA with a friend. I was kitting out a new place that I've got, Sangadeva, some of you know. And we were walking through IKEA, and I was very businesslike. I knew exactly what I wanted. But I saw that Sangadeva was wandering around with a big grin on his face. And I thought, guy's been taken in. He's bought, he thinks he's a Swede. And I sort of asked him, what's happening? And he said, I'm just really enjoying the fact I don't want any of this. And in a way, Buddhism, the Buddhahood is like that on the biggest possible scale. It's where you don't want any of it. You can enjoy, you can take it, you can leave it, but you're not out to buy it. But we rely upon, we have this subtle idea of a set of material circumstances which will endure and where we will have arrived. It's not true. This is the Buddha's fundamental analysis. These delusions are ignorance. Thinking that there are permanent things, thinking that there are substantial things that are real and really existent, thinking that we can create a set of worldly circumstances that are entirely satisfactory. It's a delusion. It's silly. But we all, deep down, even if we pay lip service to not believing it, deep down we're quite committed to it. And it's the aggregation of that that creates a world in which suffering happens, in which we suffer because we don't, it's not true and we don't get what we want, and we cause suffering to others because in our scramble to get the circumstances that we think we need or deserve, we harm others and we compete with them. So this makes insight into what really is going on extremely important. It's our failure to understand what's really going on that creates the problems that I talked about at the beginning. So whilst there may be solutions on their own level, technological solutions, economic solutions, political solutions, and so forth, the fundamental solution lies in more people having a deeper understanding of the way life really is. Well, that means they need to hear messages such as those given by the Buddha Dhamma. To my taste, and you know, I don't want to end up quarrelling with somebody, which is exactly what we're trying to get away from. For my taste, the Buddha expresses that in a particularly clear and uncompromising way. He expresses the facts of existence in a particularly clear and uncompromising way. And, well, clearly that means people need to hear it. People need to hear that message about the way life really is. And they need to hear it in a cogent way that is persuasive to them, that they can check against their experience and that meets the real issues and difficulties that they face. You know, we face a temporary, probably temporary economic crisis, banking crisis, which is having a huge effect, 2,000 people in Birmingham losing their jobs, etc. Well, somebody who's, where is he, a builder? Plasterer. Yeah, not so much work around. My own builder, Marion Jones, not so much work, he says. So it's having immediate repercussions, the fact that, you know, the American regulators and the British regulators didn't check whether banks were really lending properly, sensibly. So it really has an immediate effect. And it's time when people can think. That they may be sort of really just wanting a new job, but it's a time for them to think. What does it mean? Why have you come to this situation? What is it that has created this situation? So, that's just an example. There are many, many situations in life where people are brought up against the limitations of a sort of consumer dream that we live within, that we've been beguiled into in Europe for the last, and America too, for the last 40, 50 years, to see, well, what its underlying nature is and how it works and how it cannot always deliver what it promises to deliver. So we need to get the Buddhist message across into the debate about these things. We need to be showing that the Dhamma has an immediate relevance to these issues. We need to be trying to find out where the shoe is pinching and show why it's pinching there, if you see what I mean. That, I think, is the task we need to perform in our European culture and American culture and our Western culture, you could say. We need to be addressing the real issues that people are confronting. For instance, there's fascinating that it's not so hot now, is it? But there's a sort of debate about what it is to be British because of the changing ethnic constitution of Britain. And there was a period when this debate was going on and the questions being asked in Parliament and so forth. And I thought, well, really, Buddhists have got something to say about that. That a nation cannot rely only on ethnic or historical roots It cannot rely, as America does, on Enlightenment, European Enlightenment principles. It has to rest upon a shared ethical perspective, a shared ethic of what one human being owes another. And that seemed to me a public debate in which we had something to say, but we didn't. We weren't there. We weren't being heard. And the debate went mainly in the direction of what I think of as a rather woolly liberalism. I'd rather a woolly liberalism than a steely non-liberalism. But it seemed to me that the debate went much deeper than it was being taken. So yes, I think that we probably don't ourselves sufficiently recognise the power of the Dhamma to transform the world. The Buddha considered the Dhamma to be the medicine for the suffering world. He used that image, the Dhammosada, the Dhamma as medicine. In some Buddhist traditions, the Buddha is spoken of as the great doctor, the great physician, because he deals with the fundamental suffering which people experience because of their delusion, because they don't see life as it really is. So, yes, we need to appreciate more fully and deeply, I believe, I feel quite passionately, the power of the Dhamma to deal with the crisis that the world faces. Of course, we alone are not going to solve it, and even Buddhists alone are not going to solve it. There are people of goodwill from other faiths, from no faiths. We need to cooperate with them. But I believe that the Buddha Dhamma has something unique and uniquely clear and penetrating to offer to that that debate. So that comes back, what about us? I'm saying that I think we, as Buddhists or interested in Buddhism, have some possibility of making a far deeper, far more crucial contribution to the longer-term solution to the crisis that the world faces. What do we do? What do we individually do? Well, of course, the first thing we need to do is to get wise ourselves. We need to get over our own ignorance. We need to at least lessen our ignorance. I don't think you should wait until you're a Buddha before you do something, because the situation is too urgent. And anyway, it's hard to do that without making a contribution. So, yes, but we need to work on ourselves so that our motivation is pure, so that our own understanding of the real nature of things is at least clear. It may not be reached the level of insight yet, but it needs to be clear. We need to be able to live in accordance with that and to be working that into our experience. So that's the first thing. We need to be practicing very vigorously ourselves so that we overcome our greed, hatred and delusion, and we at least stop contributing to the problem. I think this has quite large repercussions in our lives. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Of course, fundamentally it means living by the precepts, or rather, to begin with, it means living by the precepts, because the precepts are the principles of non-harm. So you're withdrawing from your contribution to the mass of ignorance, the mass of ignorance the Buddha talked about. That's the first thing, working on yourself. Then I think you need to, that is working on yourself in the sense of meditating, of practicing ethics, of studying the Dhamma, of communicating with each other in genuine friendship on the basis of the Dhamma, of worshipping the Buddha, so that you have some higher factor in your life which raises you up, worshipping the Buddha as embodying the transcendence of ignorance. Yes, you need to be doing all that. But what about your home life? I've been thinking about this quite a bit because I've seen, our modern consumer society delivers such gratification. It delivers more, better, faster, bigger, etc. all the time. I participate in that by waiting until people throw things away. So I've got a big telly, but it's 10 years model ago. And it's incredible. I've never seen anything like it before. Huge. It's about sort of that big. Sorry, I got lost in my own joke. We need to reconsider our own membership of the consumer society, our own participation in the consumer treadmill, the consumer impetus. Because you can't help it. You've got a computer, and then you find next year there's a bigger and better one. You don't actually need it, but you sort of have to have it. You know, some people do, of course. It does help them. I'm not against technology. But there's a sort of drive in the whole system. Because it requires growth, it's very, very good at enticing you for more. And it catches that sense in you that more is better, bigger is better. And this sort of drive towards the transcendence of dukkha by consumption. That's essentially what the consumer society is. This is not a joke. The consumer society is a running to keep ahead of pain, of the essential nature of things. So we need to think about that. Each and every one of us, we need to think about our participation in that consumer treadmill. We need to think about in what way are we bought into it. And, you know, even buying a second-hand or a thrown-away telly, I'm sort of contributing to it. So we need to consider that quite radically. I think we need to think about how we can simplify our lives. Simplification isn't just a matter of as it were, a politico-economic action of withdrawing from the consumer society. Simplification means coming back to immediate experience. It means coming back to what's actually happening now. The force of consumer culture is towards what I call secondary reality. I'll talk more about it tomorrow. But to living in a sort of an electronic simulacrum of the world. I went to lunch with somebody today, and sitting in the cafe, I was just sort of looking around. Most people were on their mobile phones, texting, talking. I saw two people sitting next to each other. They'd clearly come out for a meal. A very attractive woman and a not so attractive guy. I don't know what she saw in him. sitting side by side. I would have been just looking at her, to be frank. But, gosh, lovely to be with blokes, isn't it? Couldn't do that on Monday. they were both on their mobile phones. But what a waste. It's a real human being in front of you, but, you know, you're on your... Maybe they're doing work, they've probably got a good excuse, but it just seemed that so much of life like that. You see people walking along, talking to themselves, you think, God, there's so many nutters around these days. And, instead of actually knowing where you are, you're somewhere else. It's a tremendous effort to put your mind into a phone call, I find. I couldn't do it when I came out of solitary retreat. It just exhausted me, the sort of mental effort of constructing from the tinny sounds that you're getting a voice and a person at the other end of it. Anyway, that's another matter. So I think a simple life means coming back to actually basic sensory experience, feeling things, experiencing your immediate sensations. That, for Buddhism, is the foundation for mindfulness. Mindfulness begins with the body. And there's so much of modern consumer society which takes us away from our immediate experience. And that therefore generates powerful urges to sensation, which partly are a cause of problem. Because you're not feeling much directly, you want more powerful sensations. It's got to be louder, bigger, brighter, flashier, etc. So we need to think about that. To what extent is our consumption, our buying into the consumer system, fueling that system and therefore causing suffering, directly and indirectly? To what extent are we actually alienating ourselves and failing to experience the immediate sensations which are the basis for our realization? A much larger topic, but I hope you can reflect further on that. So I think we need to think about simplifying our lives. I think we need to think about the way in which we live together. If you've got a family, if you live with a partner, if you live with other people, of course you do think about it. But we need to think about how we can radicalize that so that we can meet more deeply and fully as human beings, so that we can support ourselves in what is truly human about us, which is the impetus to grow, the impetus to develop, to become something more. We need to think about the way we structure our lives, the way we interact with each other, the way we spend our time together. It needs to be radicalized. I don't think you have to leave your family in order to make real spiritual progress. But you do need to think about how you live with your family, the way you relate. Of course, you know, there's another person there or other people there. They've got their own wishes and interests and desires. But as much as possible, you need to live as human beings together, valuing what is most essential about us as human beings, which is that in us which wishes to go further. We need to think about our social lives. To what extent are our social lives simply consumption, part of the consumer system? To what extent are our social lives supporting our growth as human beings, supporting our recognition of the real nature of things, living in accordance with the real nature of things? We need to develop what we call sangha, and we need to put real effort into that. Because the more sangha there is, the bigger effect we can have on the wider society. Finally, just for the present purpose, I say we need to think about what we can do alone and with our friends to help people to overcome ignorance. Of course, you have to be overcoming ignorance yourself in order to help anybody at all. But what can you do to communicate the Buddha's radical vision of the way life really is, and his radical communication of how to live happily and at peace? We need to get that message across. Not just waiting for people to come into the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. We need to get out and find the sources of communication. Find where the shoe pinches. The Buddha said that the Dhamma is the medicine for the world. It's for all human beings. Everybody experiences suffering. Everybody experiences limitation. We need to try to find out, it may be, you know, sort of analyse, as it were, the world around us. See where the shoe pinches and see how the Dhamma relates to that situation. It won't necessarily be the way it relates to yours. So, for instance, to the young gypsy boy who's not had any education in Hungary, you know, meditation is completely boring. But there is a point which it connects with him. Can't remember what it is now. No, there is a point at which it connects with him. And you need to find that out with the Dalit in India. You know, the shoe pinches with the caste system. So what has the Dhamma got to say about that? So we need to be thinking about the world around us and going beyond our present pool, as it were. We appeal to certain people, but there are many, many more people who could benefit from the Dhamma, who could benefit from hearing the Buddha's understanding of the way life is, who could overcome their ignorance and live at least a better life, a happier life, and contribute to making a better society, a better world. So I think these are the three principal things we need to do, four things we need to do. First of all, we need to practice. We need to really overcome ignorance in ourselves. By all the expedients that you've learnt and love here at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. We need to think about the way we live, our home life, our domestic life, our work life. We need to radicalise that, simplify it, and bring it back to basic experience, and buy out or check out of the consumer treadmill as much as we can. We need to build Sangha. We need to develop a new social life, a social life that's based upon shared values about discovering the real nature of things, growing beyond our ignorance. And we need to work together to reach many, many more people in society with the Buddha's message about the way life really is, and help them to see how that fits with their own problems, where the shoe pinches them. So, I feel I've sort of said something of what I want to say, communicated something of my own conviction that the Dhamma is the vital element that is needed to resolve the problems of the world. A real understanding of the nature of things. Real understanding, facing up to the way life is and how we can live happily with the way things are. And, if we all do our bit, we may not be able to stave off the crisis. Who knows? It's huge. And it involves cooperation between many, many, many people. And it requires a huge amount of luck, sheer luck, whatever that is. But we can certainly contribute. And it may be that our contribution will help a sort of a snowball to roll. And we have to just work with that possibility. There's no good saying, I'm going to save the world. You can't. But what you can do is be definitely on the side of the forces that are helping. And if enough people buy into that, it's possible. It's possible that we may survive this century. It's possible that those of you who have children, your children, will live in a better world, a world which is less threatened. But if we don't, we may be able to hope that a lot of other people will do it. But if we don't, if we as Buddhists, as people interested in Buddhism, don't do it, well, how can we really expect anything to be resolved? So there you are. That's what's been preoccupying me. That's a sort of a very strong fuel for my own life at the moment. The sense that the Dhamma really can change not just individual lives, but our collective life, and perhaps even our global life.